First of all, will you just introduce yourself to me and tell me about your current political aspirations?
Thanks. Well, I'm Pat McCullough. I'm running for mayor. And I actually want to leave the city because I've seen a lot of things that can happen. And as I mentioned before, I just don't see other people putting it together to make it happen for us. I've been disappointed in a lot of the elected officials. I've gone to many of them for help over the years. And I think the response I got is pretty typical, is that they often have said, well, we can't do this for you, or this hasn't been done before, or we'll look into it. And I'm saying, like, hey, no, I need this to happen right now. I need an answer right now. And I even maybe I just need you to move out the way right now so I can do it. I've got this part handled. I just need to know if I'm stepping on any official toes or if this is something that you've already begun. But let me know so I can make progress. But I've ran into roadblocks dealing with people, and if it weren't for my natural tendency, and my dad often reminds me of this, when somebody tells me I can't do something, that's usually the thing that makes me go for it even more. And that's been my experience here in Oakland. But then I know that many of other people who needed the same help from elected officials, needed some leadership, so maybe they didn't even need to have to ask for the help. They didn't get it. And a lot of folks just give up. And, I mean, a lot of people have even moved from Oakland because of this. I mean, I talked to people who said, well, I give up on this place. And I don't want anybody else to give up on it because I see the consequences of giving up. One of the consequences is this big talk about gentrification, which drives me up the wall because I'm going, well, wait a minute. Who are the leaders who are now bemoaning gentrification? Where were they when this thing started? Didn't they see this coming like 10 years ago, what the housing crisis was going to do? How can they, in any good conscience, say that they need now leadership to get to reverse the course of gentrification when the harbingers of it were right in front of them? They should have seen this coming. I mean, my wife and I saw it coming. I have friends who saw it coming, but I'm getting stuck with these leaders, and who knows, I may wind up naming some of them. But it just bothers me that they don't show the leadership when it's necessary, and then later their leadership seems to be mainly to rally people to complain about the new problem, which was really created when they had an opportunity to prevent it.
And so let's talk a little bit about, Oakland's undergoing a lot of dynamic change right now. Gentrification is one of those big things that we can really see that's very tangible. What are some of the other big changes that you see happening in Oakland right now?
One of the biggest changes is this relationship to the sports teams. And I don't want to say that's just the thing that came to my mind first, but it was something I was thinking about earlier this morning. I have a friend who's really into sports and stuff, and he wants me to take a stronger stance for retaining the teams. And for me, I'm saying, well, I don't necessarily want to retain the teams. I'd like them to be here, but what's it worth for Oakland to have the teams? I mean, I know some people just love them and can't go to sleep without them. But as I press this person who's been very involved in even the negotiations for having the Raiders here and with the Coliseum leases, so I press this person. I said, okay, make the case to me why they should be here. How much money does Oakland get? What are the benefits that Oakland gets from having these teams versus how much we put into it? He can't give me the numbers. He just keeps repeating how much we need it and that there are many people who depend on it. There are a lot of jobs at the Coliseum, and I understand that these people have been working, but I pressed further and said, okay, how many of these people live in Oakland? I understand there are a lot of jobs. How many of them live there? And versus spending the money there to keep their jobs at the Coliseum, what else could we do for this money that we're putting into the Coliseum? Perhaps it seems we can have these same people employed doing other things. What's the net for the food concessions? How much of that money stays here? And all these people who love the team so much, it seems that they should be willing to pay for it. particularly the people who don't live in Alameda County, who come here. You know, they come here from Concord. I'm glad. I want you to come to Concord from Concord and spend your money in Oakland. But when it comes to the Coliseum, this is something that we pay for around the clock. And I just got through watching another losing game with the Raiders. And I'm thinking, well, okay, is this the best we can do, is to have a team that we're paying way too much for that doesn't really seem to be producing the benefits in Oakland that they touted a long time ago? Somebody needs to make the case to me that this is a benefit for Oakland, worth Oakland residents putting more money into it to keep them. And I haven't seen that happen yet. Still another week or two, maybe it will.
I mean, there's an argument to be made that it's not, you know, sports teams in a place is also really about the identity of a place. It's not just about the economic benefits, right?
And like art museums and things, you know, and I'll put into that. Okay, that's great. Now, I know that we need these things as part of the culture, but reduce it to numbers for me. Okay, I can reduce things to number. And when people were proponents for things, I expect them to be able to do it too. And I haven't seen that number yet. I mean, I still got it out there. Maybe somebody's going to send me an email saying this is how it all breaks down. But, you know, I'm pretty happy with the Niners, you know, and I don't watch basketball at all. And, you know, I kind of think one of the problems that we've had with Oakland youth and pretty much black youth throughout the country is that they put too much emphasis on making it in sports. You know, I want to get away from that. You know, how about putting all that energy into creating some energy-saving product or some energy-producing product or something that can reduce some of the waste or the poisons that we have. That's what I want to see people excited about. You know, wear a sweatshirt that says a waste reducer instead of just, you know, wasting money team. So it's there's a lot more I'd rather see people spend their energy and our scarce resources on than sports teams that don't seem to really want to be here, don't want to pay their way, and aren't offering a whole lot of real promise for people who claim that they can't live without them. You know, I wonder, well, geez, you do all this here for a team that's lousy and is not doing well. How would you do if you had some enterprise here that was just really going gangbusters, like our own homegrown, I don't want to say Google, but, you know, some company that started here and made some product here that is now used with around the world. And I've got products. I mean, you know, I got a lot of things on my mind, a lot of things I have to deal with. But I think of products regularly. And I'd say, yeah, you know, maybe if for some reason, I know what the reason would be, I don't win as a mayor, then okay, I'll probably want to get some of these products out on the market. But why aren't other people doing these things? And, you know, is there some reason why the government isn't behind these things and why none of these things have come to fruition?
Let's talk a little bit about what you want to see happen and what you would want to push forward if you get elected as mayor. Like, what are some of the things that you're really that really made you decide that you wanted to run?
The biggest thing is I really want to, and I know I will once I'm elected, make Oakland a safer place. It's just ridiculous how it is now. There's way too much righteous fear for one's safety. There's a fear that keeps people away from Oakland, so that cuts down our economic progress. I hear that there's no hope among the younger people, and I think a lot of it is because they're on the verge, they're facing life and death decisions every day, and they don't really see a change coming. So they rationalize, hey, there's too great a chance that my life could end. So I'm only going to concern myself with the things that are bringing me pleasure and maybe some sense of security right now. Often those things won't carry them any further. And that's been like this vicious cycle we've been locked into. So just real quickly, one of the things that bothered me the most about this thing is that, you know, there's a lot of pronounced distrust of the police in Oakland. Several years ago, a young man a few blocks from here was killed by one of our Oakland officers. And, you know, I met the officer, and so I know this guy. He doesn't, he's not a racist guy. He doesn't wake up in the morning and says, let me hurry into Oakland, put on my uniform so I can go and brutalize and, you know, be dismissive of the black people in this city. And maybe if I'm really lucky, I'll be able to kill one before the day is over, right? That is not his mentality or any other cop's mentality in the city. Now, according to the officer, and, you know, the facts have been out and they pretty much haven't survived any dispute, is that the officer tried to stop the guy. The guy either broke away from the officer or turned, and the officer saw the guy had a gun in his waistband or somewhere on his person, and told him to, gave him a command to stop, and in fear of his life, he shot the guy. And, you know, it was a tragic thing, and I saw the picture of the guy. I says, geez, you know, he's a real handsome-looking guy. You know, I think he was the only child. And, you know, I just imagine what his parents felt, you know, that huge loss. And I see what it did for the community. A lot of people liked the guy, and now he's dead. And I said, geez, this is awful, you know, because I know we got a good cop here who really wants to make Oakland safer. We have this guy's parents who went through a lot of work for 20 years to raise this guy to the point, you know, where they probably were hoping that he'd go on and have a nice life. But the real tragedy came up beyond his death when the parents were being interviewed by a reporter, and I believe the father said, well, yeah, I don't believe my son had a gun, and, you know, and that was wrong that he got killed. But then the mother says, well, if he had a gun, he needed it to protect himself. So I was looking at this vicious circle that came up because of distrust of the police. Now, he didn't need the gun to protect himself from the police. The gun was to protect themselves from people that the police should have been protecting their son from. But instead of having the right orientation, okay, when the police come, the game is over, you know, go limp, follow their commands, don't present yourself as a threat. He had this other thing in his mind still about resisting, and the resisting is what led immediately to his death. But that could have, even if he had resisted and ran away, I think that there's a great likelihood he'd be alive if he did not have the gun on him. And that's was this thing that many youth still cling to, this thing of, well, I have enemies, the police aren't here to protect me, maybe they even hate me too, but when I need one, I don't see one to protect me. So, okay, the guy gets killed, and it's back to this thing of his friends still hate the police. They aren't cooperating with the police. And there have been other shootings in that area. And, of course, there's no good witnesses because they don't want to be a witness. They don't want to cooperate with the police. And some of them, because they just hate the police, don't want to have anything to do with them. But others aren't good witnesses because they fear retaliation from the people who are out doing the crime. So it's like, well, okay, so now what are these people going to do? They're just going to live with the crime, which encourages the criminals to keep doing what they wanted to do. So I can break through all that because I've been through all these things. I've experienced both sides of the law myself. A lot of people don't know this, so I'll be glad to tell you now. It was asked me just recently, and I was glad to bring it up. But, you know, a lot of people are saying, you know, this whole thing, recent stuff in Ferguson, Missouri, and other areas of the country, New York, is that, you know, they still got this thing in the head that many police want to kill us. And I saw this thing happen in South Carolina, I believe it was, where it looks like this cop just went off, and he was, I don't know if he was too skittish to be out there or what, but I'm listening to him give this guy orders in his car. The guy follows the orders. He doesn't really seem to be a danger, but if you're afraid of your shadow, then you're going to think that what that guy did was a life and death situation causing incident, and the cop shot him fortunately, that guy survived. But so for myself, and I think the thing that I can really bring to these youth is I know just what that's like, because not only have I had have had cops and military point guns at me before, I've had, at least three instances in Oakland where Oakland cops have pointed guns at me. And all those instances, all those things worked out well. Okay. One time could have been a tragic mistake, could have developed from that, but it all worked out well. The cops were polite, treated me respectfully, weren't harsh, and, everything was cool, almost textbook. But when I was 14 or 15 years old, I was back in Chicago, and a friend of mine decided we're going to do something that kids shouldn't have done back then, but they did, and the consequences usually weren't very great. And that was to do what they call joyriding. You take a car that isn't yours, and you go off and ride to go see your girlfriends, which is what we did that day. On the way there, these cops spotted us. And make it real quick, what happened was we basically ran from the car and the police shot at us. Now, I fell while we were running, jumping hedges. And I fell just like instantly. You know, my foot got trapped in the bushes and I went straight over. My friend, who was just a bit shorter than me, he was a few inches shorter, got shot in the shoulder. The bullet grazed his shoulder. Well, that would have hit me in the back or in the head. And, I probably wouldn't have survived. And so when I hear about people being shot now, I say, yeah, I mean, I know that those things have happened in the past and they can happen. Now, back then, the law was different. Police could shoot at what they called fleeing felons, and that was fine. The felon did not have to turn and point at the police before it was justifiable to shoot him. You just run. I mean, in fact, I was watching an old movie a few days ago where this guy's just running from the police, and they, I believe it was Crossfire with Robert Young, whoever was in that movie, Robert Mitchum. It was like three Roberts in the movie, and they wind up at the end shooting this guy through a window, and they're up on the second floor. The guy's down in the street. He doesn't have a weapon, and they shoot him in the back. That's the proper end for the movie. Well, that was the rule then. The rules are different now, and cops know that. But they also have to know that these circumstances can all of a sudden lead from one safe place to another precarious place real quick. The cops must keep that in mind, and the people on the street have to keep that in mind. And the youth will have to be taught, because apparently their parents and whoever they've been listening to, their leaders, haven't taught them. The time for protesting bad police action isn't at the street. That's not at the time to do it. Time to do it is just submit to whatever it is they're doing and go hire your lawyer later. There are plenty of lawyers who are just real quick to jump on this. You know, you go to them and says, hey, I was hassled and, I want to sue. Or if I'm the mayor, you can just come to me. Tell me about this. I'll talk to the cops and I'll talk to the youth and or older people, whoever's involved, and straighten it out right away. I mean, I don't care about the restrictions on talking to city employees and the rights they have to not give statements. I'm quite sure that everybody will want to talk to me, because my purpose is to get these things resolved so we can make the progress that we've been trying to make for a long time.
Now, let me ask you, as mayor, what would you do to work within the police department? I mean, there's a lot of issues with with Oakland Police. One of them being that they're, chronically understaffed, or there's, not enough. Many people would say there's not enough of a police presence on the streets.
That's a huge problem. And it's one of the things that leads to other problems, because, I'm a blue collar worker. Now I work in the city where you live. And I know that people can only do so much work before they get tired. And, and then you're working day after day on overtime. And in the case of the police, under a lot of stress. So what we have are a bunch of shell-shocked cops barely able to maintain being forced to do another shift. So immediately I must increase the ranks of the police. And one way that, and this is, again, one of the things that I have as an idea, and I'm surprised that other people haven't done anything about this because it's something they could have done many years ago, is to use, well, before I get to the punchline of this, they talk about how the cops aren't familiar with the residents, aren't in tune with them, don't understand them, don't care about them. Some of them are, too pushy. Well, the solution for a lot of this is to hire retired policemen or people who are of retirement age who otherwise would leave the department with all this experience, with all this wisdom, and just be gone. I want to use the retired policemen. I want to have at least 100 policemen who could have otherwise or may have retired on the police force in Oakland. And I want to keep at least 100 of them there. I think we need that level of experience. It's going to cost us a lot less money to hire these officers than to keep the other officers pre-retirement. You know, it's amazing the difference. Just give you an offhand figure, $30 an hour versus what is approximately about $55 an hour for us to pay for the policemen and their benefits.
Yeah. Wait, where do you get those numbers?
Oh, I did the math. Yeah, I know.
I mean, why is it less for a retired cop to stay on? Why? I don't understand what the difference is in pay.
It's a different pay scale. Yeah, we have them in Berkeley, for instance, utilized. It's been using them for a long time as school resource officers. They do, and of course, the school resource officers don't just stay in the school. They're all over the place, too. But other cities do this. And, you know, it's just one of these things. Well, why haven't they done this here? And one of the things may be because of some, who knows, employee rules or whatever it is will change, whatever it is stopping it from happening. It's one of these stupid things that we just need to eliminate. I don't know how it came to be, but this is what we need to do for the future, is have many of these retired officers here to mentor the younger officers, to be a bridge between the community and the newer officers. I mean, it's just the solution that we should have had in place a long time ago, but it's one thing that I'll be pushing to have my first year in office.
That's really interesting. And it's an interesting idea, really, to have a kind of a mentorship going on. One thing that we didn't talk about in terms of you being on, having been on many sides of this sort of public safety line and, interacting with the police and also with some of the problems in Oakland is what happened back in 2005.
Oh, I almost forgot about that.
I know it's something that we should talk about. Yeah. And, and that was right in this.
Right here at this location. And actually what happened in 2005, was just a later event for what had been going on since I moved here and why I'm running for mayor. My wife and I moved here, and this is also, tying into the whole gentrification issue. My wife and I moved here in 1994, bought our home under the first-time home buyers program that Oakland had. We had been looking around the Bay Area, and, we were pretty familiar with the Bay Area, but not so much with this part of Oakland. My wife knew that there were some areas in East Oakland that we should avoid, but we just didn't know this area had problems too. So immediately when we moved here, we started encountering problems with crime. There would be guys right in front of the house. I mean, right on the sidewalk, 10 feet from my window, selling drugs. So I began by going out and telling guys, hey, you can't do that here, And sometimes that would be enough. The guy who I told that to, you can't do that here, would leave. But sometimes there'd be somebody else who would come back and take his place. So I'd have to tell that person too. Well, after a couple of weeks, I started taking pictures of the people who were out there because I said, okay, you feel you have a right to do this in public. I know I have a right to take your picture in public. Okay, so it became this thing of you're exercising your rights, I'm exercising mine. Okay, and there's this other competing issue where I'm responsible for the sidewalk in front of my house. You know, somebody trips on a crack and breaks a leg, I'm responsible. There's trash on the street, I'm expected to pick it up. But for some reason, they expect me to tolerate criminals standing on the sidewalk. And that's a political decision that I won't agree with. So there were other neighbors in this on this block and in the area who also were troubled by crime. Some of them been dealing with it even longer than me, years before I moved in. So while I'm here, from 94 on, my wife and I, this is our regular practice. You know, we see the people, we try to talk to them, try to show our presence. And this is one, again, this is one reason why we moved here is because, you know, my wife is also black, and we figured, great, you know, we're going to be great role models for somebody. You know, they're going to see these two people who went to night school, who come from big cities, who were born into poverty, who've overcome all this stuff. And now they're going to work every day and trying to build a wonderful life. And somebody's going to see this and say, you know, that's possible. I can do it, too. But instead, what we were hit with were people saying, oh, these McCulloughs are here to gentrify the neighborhood. And, you know, I actually talked to some of the people right away when this first came up. I said, what do you mean by how is gentrifying something that's bad if the only part that we have in it is to live the way that you should be living? And so I basically, you know, just pointed out that they're whole rationalization was ridiculous. I mean, it's like, this is what you should want for yourself. So this went on for years, you know, call the police, take pictures, you know, then over the years, people would throw things at the house. You know, we had a car shot. We've had neighbors threatened. You know, I'd be at meetings, people would threaten me. But, you know, a lot of it was just talk. And everything was fairly safe as far as physical violence until, I think it was about 2002. Somebody, and I'm getting the dates a little hazy here, but because of several things happened. But at one point, we had some people throw, well, one guy threw this brick. We never did see who it was. Threw this big chunk of concrete through the front window, right while I was sleeping on the couch, as you passed there. Different couch, but same window. So after that, several months later, there was an incident where a guy who used to live across the street was dealing. And I called his landlord and said, hey, this guy lives in your building, sits on your steps, and he's dealing all the time. You know, I got pictures of him doing it. You know, can you stop it? Or do I have to keep trying on my own to get it stopped? So later that day, that night, I had gone to the grocery store, Safeway's up on College. I get back home. I'm taking the groceries out of my car and walking along the driveway to get to my front steps. And here's this guy, 6'2", a lot bigger than me, 200-something pounds. And he's got his two friends down at the end of the driveway. And we wind up tussling because it started off, the guy says, hey, are you the one who called the police on me? And I said, well, probably, because that's what I'll do. And he surprised him that I admitted that. And but I'm also looking at him like, hey, you know, I'm an adult. You should be first addressing me as Mr. And the fact that you haven't lets me know that, you know, you aren't quite with how our relationship is. You know, I'm the adult here and I'm not going to let you dictate to me anything. So we went on back and forth talking for a couple of minutes. And then I felt certain he was about to attack me. So I tried to knock him out with one punch. And I studied martial arts, but I miscalculated. And he didn't hit the ground like I thought he would. And we wind up wrestling down the driveway. And then at the end of his driveway, his two friends join in and trip me. And now I'm wrestling and being kicked by all three of them. And I realize this guy is now trying to kill me. You know, he's trying to smash my head in the ground. You might notice a little scar here I got from that encounter. So from that point on, I realized, you know, I can't just depend on talking with these people because they have evil intent in their heart. When they come to deal with me, they aren't thinking about my family, you know, about the life I want. They just want to pursue their criminal intent. And I'm in the way of that, and they'll kill me and not think twice about it because that's the way they do with other people. So I made a point on that day to heed the advice of police and start carrying a pistol. I mean, I've had a couple of people who were district attorney. This is Alameda County district attorney investigators who told me, one of them in court, that, hey, these people don't like you. You need to do whatever you can to protect yourself. And and that was it. So the person who was, in fact, the main assailant that night was eventually charged by the district attorney, and we're in court. And that night, I'm washing dishes around 10 o'clock, and I hear gunshot. And police come, ambulance come, but, you know, I didn't want to go over there. This is on 58th Street, just one block away. I didn't want to go over there and take a look because this is a dangerous thing for me to do that, and it was unnecessary. You know, the police were handling it. Well, the next morning, I'm ready to go to court, and my next-door neighbor comes over, and he says, well, don't bother with your tie. That noise you heard last night was the defendant being killed on 58th Street. So, of course, I go on into court anyway, and sure enough, that was the end of that case. So now, even more of his friends are mad at me because, well, according to one confidential informant, the only reason why he was on 58th Street is because I made it too difficult for him to do business on 59th Street. So, you know, this logic they have makes me as much as fault as the guy who actually shot him. So, you know, when you're dealing with that kind of thinking, you can't compete with it at that level. You pretty much have to rise above it. So I'm rising at the level of I have to maintain my safety, regardless of what anyone says about it. So now we get into 2005, and another nice day. I remember it was a Friday. I had had a long day at work, but I'm watching Power Rangers with my son in the front room. And we're looking out the window. It's a drizzly day, and there's nobody around. Nobody on the street. I'm thinking, great. I don't have to call the police on anybody. I don't have to keep an eye on anybody. This looks like it's going to be a nice, quiet evening. Then my wife asked that I get some crab for dinner that night. So great. I'm going to go down to Chinatown on 12th Street. 12th Street is where I usually go. So I'm leaving the house, and now I'm picking up what's normal for me to do when I leave the house. I pick up my wallet, my glasses, my keys, my cell phone, and my pistol, one of the pistols that I keep. And now I'm ready to leave the house. You know, it's kind of funny that you have to do all this, but this is what's necessary for me. So I go to the front door. Again, I don't see anybody outside. Lock the door. Stand outside and pull my key out of the door, and all of a sudden, there's these 12 young people were walking down the sidewalk right in front of my house. Well, I see them, and I figure, okay, no big deal. You know, I've seen a lot of kids before. They've seen me before. Everybody knows the score. You know, I don't have any real need to have any interaction with them right now, so they'll keep walking where they were going, and I'll get in my car and drive away and come back with crap pretty soon. But instead, this one guy goes, hey, there's a snitch or something like that. So, again, this is part of my job as being a role model, is that they need to always know that there's a difference between teenagers and people who don't have a lot of life experience, and somebody who was, I think it was like 50 years old at that point. And so I just don't tolerate disrespect. I just don't, you know, not from the police, not from white people when I was a young black youth. I just never have, you know, because it just didn't seem the right thing to do. I look at this as like a teaching moment. And so I'm going to teach this guy that you just can't talk to anybody like that, and then that's the end of it. You don't run this world. So I told him, don't talk to me that way, boy. And I made a point of saying boy, because I'm the man and he's a boy. And if he wants to be a man, he's got a lot of learning to do. But meanwhile, you know, I'm the one with the authority, and your authority doesn't include hassling me. So he didn't like that. And so he charged at me. And when he did, I had my hands full with all my stuff, you know. He swung at me, and I pretty much dodged out the way, but he hit me in the mouth. It was a glancing blow, not very direct. So with my free hand, my right hand, I punched him in the chest and almost knocked him off his feet, which, you know, usually happens when I hit somebody. So I thought this is going to be the end of the hassle, because now I've verbally put him in his place and now I've physically done it. So as far as I'm concerned, okay, you've learned your lesson. Okay, this should be the end of the lesson now. Go on and tuck your tail between your legs and go on where you were heading before you started to hassle me. But instead, his friends start pick up the fight. And they threw a couple of rocks at me, threw this huge tree branch at me, which hit my shoulder, and then put this dent in the car that I was driving. Now my attention is pretty much focused on this mob of 12 people who are in an arc around me to my right and to the east of the street. And at the same time, this guy now walks over towards Shattuck, just about another several feet. And then I hear him clear as a bell say to two of his friends who are coming from the Shattuck direction, "Give me the pistol. Let me have the pistol." And, you know, if he would have said one of the slang words for a gun or something, I might have hesitated longer. But when he said pistol, that broke through the fog. You know, I knew exactly what he was asking for and exactly what the consequences were. So now I turn to him. These other people are still there, but this is, you know, heightened priority now. So the guy talking to, he walks right next to him, and the guy lifts up his shirt, and there in his waistband is this pistol. I see the handle sticking out. So I'm thinking, oh, I'm going to probably have to shoot this guy with the gun, because he's got the gun, he's part of this group, and they're all doing me harm right now. So while you're wondering, well, okay, how could I do this? Because I had my own pistol tucked underneath my Oakland Raiders sweatshirt, and it was practically invisible. Nobody could see it. They had no idea I had it. So when the guy who was doing all the talking, the one I had the little had a little tussle with, put his hand on the pistol, that's when I shot him in the arm. And it was like one of these Lone Ranger shots, you know, where, you know, the Lone Ranger never kills anybody, and he just does it, and they drop the gun, and, you know, and then that's it. Well, the police don't train for that. You know, that's almost impossible thing to do. It's dangerous for the policeman's safety. It's also something that is dangerous for in general, because it's a very small target that, you know, you're shooting at now somebody's arm instead of the other part of them that's much bigger. And but God was with me and really guided that bullet to where it struck. And that stopped that guy from being able to do any harm to me right then. And he's still alive now. So that was the big event in 2005.
I mean, many people would say that is a sort of, that's a form of vigilantism, and that's a way of keep taking the law into your own hands. And is that something that you feel like is, I mean, that you feel like running for mayor, that that's something you think you want to model for people? Or how does that fit into your aspirations, your political aspirations?
I'll try to make this fast. Okay, first off, because I want people to deal with things intelligently, it's very important that they understand what vigilantism is. Now, that was an act of righteous self-defense. You know, that's it. Now, vigilantism would be if I decide to go around and go to the corners around in the neighborhood and see people standing there and go up to them and says, hey, you shouldn't be standing here on this corner. Leave the corner. If you don't leave the corner, I'm going to take you out. That's vigilantism. But what we've had in this Bay Area is that people have been so cowed by their political correctness and also by criminality that they now, oh, we don't want to offend the criminals. So, yeah, in their mind, anything that I do other than to sacrifice my life for their needs is vigilantism. So, you know, I would just, you know, I'd love to talk with any of these people who feel that way, but generally they're only good for shouting a slogan or two. They don't seem to be that involved in deep thinking. So again, you know, I believe that my actions were totally justified, and it's an example of what will happen unless leadership eliminates the need for those things to happen. Now, I would have loved it if in 94, the elected politicians I went to would have heeded my warnings and my pleas for help and actually said, okay, we're going to start changing this around right now. But they didn't, and they won't, because even now, people don't want to touch this subject. There's only one other candidate, maybe a couple of the other candidates who understand and actually agree with what happened, because they really understand how that is and the dynamics of it all. But we have these others who are lost in their wonderland of ideology that they're willing to go sacrifice my life and the lives of many others people in Oakland. On that same subject of vigilantism, to show you how backward their thinking is and how wrong it is, there was this lady who was killed in Maxwell Park area. And I heard Oakland police, and I believe it was one of the candidates, I believe that's her area, really talk against the lady by saying, well, we don't want to have vigilantism. And, you know, I said, well, this is this idiotic thinking that keeps us in the situation we're in now. You know, they had the opportunity to say, hey, this lady had a perfect right to do what she did. We should be supporting her right to be safe doing that. Yeah, so what if the criminals don't like it? So what if they're getting upset? We're not here to make them happy. We're here to make the taxpaying and law-abiding citizens happy. And if a law-abiding citizen wants to follow around somebody and annoy the hell out of them with her cell phone and whatever, because that's the only weapon she had was information. She didn't have any, she was going to put them under arrest. So this is what they want to do because it's easier for them. It's easier for the police if people don't stand up for themselves because the people can all be found cowering in their homes. So we don't have to worry about them on the street. That's one less thing to have to deal with. We don't have enough police to protect them even when they're in their homes. So we certainly don't want them on the streets interacting with criminals. But that's not the way we should have a society. We can't just turn over the society to the people who do the least for society. And if these criminals were out sweeping the streets in between robbing people, perhaps I'd give them a little more leeway. But I don't see any positive thing coming from their presence. So I'm not willing to give up my freedom and certainly not my right to defend myself to make them happy.
It's fascinating. I really do wish I could talk to you for a lot longer.
That's okay. The book will be out next year.
Are you writing a book?
Yeah, but it's probably going to be a while because I don't have time. You see all the stuff I'm doing?
Well, let me ask you something. You know, I was reading your platform, and one of the things that really stood out to me in there was that you mentioned that you're not raising any money and you're not buying any favors and you're not running a traditional campaign.
I'm redoing my signs from the 2008 city council election to be for mayor signs.
You mean like with a marker?
No, I was going to use a marker, but I actually bought paint. Yeah, I'm painting them. It's a little three-step process, and they're all sticking out in the backyard. I got a little poster farm out there.
Well, I'm curious in that light. It seems unlikely that you're going to win. Seems like the chances are pretty slim. And so I'm curious why you're running.
Well, because unlikely things have happened for me throughout my life. You know, I was born on a kitchen table in the south side of Chicago. You know, this is, and I brought this before, this is the same, during the same months that, let me see, the Supreme Court came out with the school desegregation case, I believe in March. And then in August, they lynched Emmett Till, a neighborhood kid who lived just a few blocks away from the table I was born on. So for me to get out of that atmosphere and go to some of the wonderful places I've been in life, people says, well, geez, you know, that's just not likely. You know, I remember when I became an electronics technician in the Navy, I went to a ship because I was an ace tech. I went over to a neighboring ship to do them a favor. The captain of my ship had sent me over there. And the guy had never seen a black electronics technician before and didn't believe that I was one until I asked for his superior officer to come, who had asked for me to be there. When I was in law school, everybody was chasing after my wife. You know, I mean, even a couple of the professors had the hots for her, but I got her, you know? So, there's been so many things. I mean, they'll be in the book, but much of my life has been, hey, you know, nobody does this, or you aren't likely to be able to do it. I mean, I've saved myself from drowning. You know, I've been a couple of times. I've been out in the ocean, this is in Hawaii, and wound up a long ways away from where I should be with my minimal swimming skills. But I did it, you know. I've just done so many things that the fact that it's difficult or seems impossible won't be enough reason for me to not believe that I can make it happen. So this is just another one of those things. Look at the street. I mean, look, you know, it's a lot safer than it's been ever in the last, 40 years. And, you know, I know other people have done their part too, but I don't think these things would have happened without the part that I did. So people who told me then, you can't stop the dealing here, you can't stop people from doing this and that, well, I did. So, you know, they said when I ran against the incumbent in 2008 that she was going to win. Well, she won, but it was a lot closer than she thought it would be. So we'll see how close this gets.
That's a great answer. Thank you so much for spending some time talking to me. It's been a real pleasure and very, very interesting.
Thanks, Julie. I'm so glad you came by, too. It's a nice way to spend the Sunday afternoon. Too bad we can't go and rejoice over the Oakland Raiders victory, but the Niners are still coming up.